Caroline Murphy is here with It Says in the Papers.
Caught overnight, the papers are virtually a referendum-free zone. The only front-page recognition of a story they couldn't close out is a picture on the Irish Times of Count Centre officials in Edinburgh. But at first glance, the Irish Daily Star looks as if it is anticipating the vote, only to get it wrong. Yes, screams the headline, but no, it's not an incorrect prediction from Scotland. It's actually all about soccer. Ireland looks certain, says the story, to get the green light today to host four games at the Euro 2020 soccer tournament. A source, we're told, said the Irish camp will be devastated if the bid fails, as it's already believed to be in the bag, with today's lunchtime announcement in Geneva a mere formality. Was asking Maria Doherty to join the Office Lotto Syndicate a mere formality meanwhile? Maria started work in a Donegal call centre just last Monday, we're told, on almost every front page this morning. But by Wednesday, as she says on the front of the Irish Sun, she was being paid an amount she would have had to work nearly 25 years to earn. Maria had become the 13th member of the Office Syndicate shortly before Wednesday's lotto draw, and they scooped the 4.9 million jackpot that evening. If I didn't have the €2 change, I probably wouldn't have done it, she's quoted as telling reporters as the paper feature pictures of her celebrating. Sincredible, says the Sun. But there's good news for the rest of us too, at least according to the headline on the front of the Irish Independent. Alongside their picture of a smiling Maria, the headline on the lead story is "We'll thrive for a decade." It's about the economy, of course, but don't get too excited. Taoiseach warns against big tax cut in budget, is the headline on the front of the Irish Times. Arthur Beasley says, Enda Kenny warned last night that resurgent economic growth would not free the government to deliver a big tax cut in next month's budget. We're told he declared that the decisions taken in coming weeks could secure Ireland's recovery or threaten it. The Taoiseach, it's explained, was speaking at a business dinner, and the headline on it all on the front of the Examiner also reports on what he said. Budget priority is to cut 52% income tax rate, is the headline there. We're told Mr. Kenny said the government's priority was to reduce that rate on low and middle income earners, and that he labelled it as anti-enterprise, anti-investment and anti-jobs. Perhaps we should all be a little more anti-tablets and smartphones when it comes to our children, at least according to the lead story in the Irish Daily Mail. Our children learning first words on apps, says the headline, while the story adds that this may stunt their development. We're told parenting and psychology experts have voiced their concern that uncontrolled use of the internet along with smartphones and tablets could create a generation unable to catch a ball or cross a road, out of touch with reality, unable to relate socially, and unable even to bond with their mothers. The lead story in the Examiner, meanwhile, is on IT difficulties at Cork University Hospital, while that paper also finds front page space to report that a man was apparently asked to get down out of a tree, which he had climbed in an attempt to see Kerry train in advance of this week's All-Ireland final. Otherwise, this morning, the Times finds front page space to report what the headline says are mounting protests by asylum seekers over delays. Protests are spreading as residents in a fifth centre demonstrated, we're told. While The Independent has a piece on water. One in 10 households is at a risk of lead poisoning from ageing pipes supplying their water, says Paul Melia, who adds that replacing lead pipes will be one of Irish Water's main priorities. But finally this morning, Jim McGuinness's main priority this week is of course landing Sam. But in The Examiner, John Fogarty writes about times when the inspirational manager wasn't as self-assured. Self-doubt almost ruined Jim, is the headline there over a piece which charts McGuinness's journey to now, from a disastrous junior cert through doing his leaving in his 20s and to being overcome by nerves as he started in Tralee IT at 24. But the single biggest lesson he learnt along the way, which he brings to management, he used to call it locked on, says Fogarty. He now terms it nailed on. More than anything, says Fogarty, McGuinness believes in the word focus.
Morning Ireland, it's 16 minutes past 8. It's no. Scotland has rejected independence. All votes are now counted. 55% of voters voted no, 45% yes. Speaking outside 10 Downing Street in London this morning, the British Prime Minister David Cameron said the independence debate has now been settled for a generation, but promised more powers to Scotland and to Wales, Northern Ireland and England too.
I can announce today that Lord Smith of Kelvin, who so successfully led Glasgow's Commonwealth Games, has agreed to oversee the process to take forward these devolution commitments, with powers over tax, spending and welfare, all agreed by November, and draft legislation published by January. Just as the people of Scotland will have more power over their affairs, so it follows that the people of England, Wales and Northern Ireland must have a bigger say over theirs. The rights of these voters need to be respected, preserved and enhanced. It is absolutely right that a new and fair settlement for Scotland should be accompanied by a new and fair settlement that applies to all parts of our United Kingdom.
And that was David Cameron speaking outside number 10 earlier this morning. We're joined on the line by our own Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade, Charlie Flanagan. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Christopher.
Thank you for joining us. Enda Kenny said, of course, that our government wouldn't be commenting one way or another during the debate. Now, of course, that moratorium is up. You can talk. What's your reaction?
Well, it has been an electrifying campaign, not only over the last 3 weeks, but over the last 3 years. We've had a huge turnout in Scotland, and the campaign, although we were a neutral neighbour, we were nevertheless very interested in the debate. It was most engaging, it was passionate, it was very controversial.
Is this the outcome you would have wanted?
Well, we were neutral. And I think it was important, as you mentioned earlier, that the Irish government remained in a position of neutrality, in the same way as if we were having a national referendum, which we've had over the last while. We felt it would be appropriate that other jurisdictions wouldn't interfere or influence.
Arguably, we have the lesser of two headaches, or certainly your ministerial brief does, because although Scotland isn't going to become an independent country away from the United Kingdom, it will have considerably greater devolved powers to Holyrood, and also the Prime Minister of Great Britain this morning talking about more devolved powers to Northern Ireland and other parts of the UK. How do you see that as a challenge for this government in the coming months and years?
Undoubtedly, there are interesting challenges ahead, and that's the nature and business of politics. And there will be some changes that may have implications for Ireland and indeed for others. But we will continue to remain in very close contact with our colleagues in London, in Edinburgh, as this work continues and indeed as the changes unfold.
Well, as the what memos have your officials prepared for you as if you like the key points that you will have to consider, that the government will have to consider?
Well, we keep very close and ongoing relations. There are implications. Obviously, there's the matter of the UK staying in the European Union, which is going to be the next big national debate in the UK. There are implications for trade and jobs, and Ireland retains one of the best investment and business partnership offerings in the world. Our nearest neighbour is our greatest trading partner, and it's our job to stay that way, and just as other countries and Scotland and indeed if there are more powers to the Parliament in Northern Ireland, you know, we will be competing to ensure that Ireland remains a most attractive place for investment, and that we will continue to forge very close political relations with our neighbours in London and Edinburgh. And it's true to say, actually, as we look at this centenary of commemorations, that the relations between Dublin and London have never been better. And that will continue to grow.
Do you accept it now as a new reality and potentially a new threat that Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, indeed England itself, can potentially become much more attractive places for foreign direct investment, the sort of jobs that this country has been so good at attracting over the last, number of decades?
Yeah, other countries will make their own offerings, will prepare the ground to ensure that they are attractive places for investment. We're up to that. We have done so to a huge extent over the past number of years as we emerged from our own economic crisis, and we're confident that we too will benefit from increased cooperation and trade with Scotland under the devolved powers as promised by Mr. Cameron.
And what about the specifics of attracting big companies to Ireland? Do you see that at a heightened threat from what can potentially now happen in a devolved, much more devolution within the United Kingdom?
I think these threats can be seen also as opportunities, and again, over the past number of years, we have seen the improved trade links between our respective islands. Trade between Ireland and Britain has never been stronger. Obviously, there will be implications for Northern Ireland. We are awaiting an announcement by Prime Minister Cameron in relation to the corporation tax. Obviously, we, as a very close neighbour, we support that in principle. It has broad support also across the Northern Ireland Executive. But the final analysis of any devolution of further powers, whether on the matter of corporation tax or any other matter, will primarily be for discussion between the Northern Ireland Executive and the British government within the framework of the Good Friday Agreement, which is the constitutional arrangement between ourselves and Belfast.
Charlie Flanagan, Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade, thank you for joining us. The time is 22 minutes past 8.
The final results now in. Those who voted no to independence, 2,001,926. Those who voted yes to independence, 1,617,989. That's 55.3% voting no, 44.7% voting yes. Gerry Adams is leader of Sinn Féin. He's on the phone. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Your own reaction to this result?
Well, the people of Scotland have spoken. I think we have to accept that. It was a very intense, informed, inclusive, and as one commentator said this morning, inspiring debate, and the turnout is proof of how lively an issue it was. I think the big thing to say is that the union has changed. It's no longer fixed, it's no longer static. We saw that with the Good Friday Agreement at negotiations in our own place. Now, the reiteration by the British Prime Minister this morning that he will keep to the promises he made around constitutional reform, about devolution of powers, not just to Scotland, but to the North as well. He has to be kept to that. And we will certainly be about doing that in the upcoming period.
Are you disappointed by the results?
At a personal level, of course. I'm a person who believes in self-determination. Sinn Féin stayed out of the debate because we thought that was a matter for people of Scotland to decide. But 1.6 million people voting for independence against the sort of tsunami of hype and pressure that came on them in the last few days of the campaign. And remember, the 2.6 or whatever it was million of people who voted to keep the union voted for a changed union. They voted for the devolution of further powers, for more control of their own affairs, and so on. So it's not static. And I commend everyone who participated in that campaign. And the fact that so many people voted, and the fact that so many people of all generations, from the elderly through to school children, because 16 and 17 year olds were allowed to vote.
Yes.
I think it's a testimony to how electrifying the debate was.
What do you think it says about Alex Salmond? What do you think it says about Scotland that over 1.6 million people were convinced to vote for independence without a bullet being fired, a bomb being exploded, or anybody being killed?
Because they had the opportunity to do it. People in Ireland were never given that opportunity. We're marking the centenary of the Home Rule Bill. Nobody in Ireland was given the right to vote for partition. We now have the right to vote. Sinn Féin, and I was part of the team, got us that right by arguing, and we didn't have the support of the Irish government on this issue, to get rid of the Government of Ireland Act and to replace it with what amounts to a very conditional commitment. The North is no longer as British as Finchley. We can't, you know, redo history or rerun history, but there's a big lesson.
Yes.
When people of Scotland were given the right to decide, to determine their own future, there wasn't, as you say, a bullet fired. Have people in Ireland been given that right a long time ago? Who knows what course our history
Yes, but by doing so without an armed campaign, what sort of inspiration does it send out for independence movements across Europe and perhaps wider afield?
Well, we now have that opportunity. We have that opportunity in our own place. And even though we have to grapple on a daily basis with the economic challenges, we should never lose sight of the fact that our people are divided, and we now have an opportunity to democratically and peacefully reunite and set ourselves on a course for happiness and for harmony across this small island. And this is a huge experiment. You will see it being picked up by people in the Basque Country, by people in Catalonia, by others across the European Union. But here especially, Sinn Féin have been arguing under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement that there is a right for a referendum on the Union, and we have been arguing for a debate on that issue. I think the centenary of the Home Rule movement will certainly give an acoustic to that, so will the 1916 celebrations, but the campaign in Scotland will accelerate that and entire process. And, you know, economics is at the core of this, and a single economic unit in Ireland, there's no reason why there should be competition between the North and the South on fundamental issues about prosperity and jobs.
Gerry Adams, leader of Sinn Féin, thank you for speaking to us. 27 minutes past eight.
And over to East Kilbride in Scotland, where we can speak to Aileen Campbell, a Scottish Nationalist Party member, member of the Scottish Parliament and Minister for Children and Young People at Holyrood. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and I'm back from East Kilbride, where the count was in my hometown of Biggar in my constituency of Clydesdale, so thank you for having me.
Oh, indeed. Well, commiserations firstly. Yeah, how do you feel?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, I've dedicated my whole political life to wanting and trying to seek independence, so disappointed. However, you know, this was an enormously positive campaign that the Yes side fought. Over a million people opted for independence. We have engaged a population, empowered a population. The population that we've been speaking to have never been as informed or as empowered as they have been through this campaign, and I think those will be the huge lessons that we take, is that this has energised a country, and we'll need to now work together to make sure that we can move Scotland forward in a really positive way.
As a politician and as a minister at Holyrood, you're a relatively young person in your 30s. Do you think you'll have another opportunity for a vote in your lifetime?
Well, you know, this was a once in a generation opportunity. You know, I guess I wake up today after a few hours sleep, and I don't turn off my feelings. I still believe that independence is the best way to serve Scotland's future. But certainly, you know, after the result, we're Democrats here, we have to acknowledge and respect the will of the people. But what it has done is changed Scotland considerably. You know, we've got to now work together towards making sure we can move forward in a positive way, make sure that people's views are respected and that they want more powers for our Parliament. And we'll need to work hard to make sure that that's delivered on. But, you know, again, you know, with the conversations that we've had, people have been talking about politics, they've been talking about the economy. They are so informed. And I think it's been an inspiration about how this campaign has been conducted in a really positive way, and we just need to now work and ensure that enthusiasm is captured and maintained as we move forward.
An extraordinary poll, 86% of the people of Scotland who could vote taking part. If you were to put your finger on a few reasons why you didn't get it over the line, why you didn't get independence, what would you select?
You know, we worked as hard as we could. You know, I suppose, you know, in the last few weeks since there had been a poll that had put the Yes campaign narrowly ahead, everything, bar including actually the kitchen sink, was flung at our campaign. You know, we've had, you know, promises of further power, the timetable set out by some London-based politicians. You know, we had a huge amount to overcome, and when you think there was only one Sunday newspaper that was pro-independence, that what we achieved in getting the results that we did was quite remarkable.
And yet 97% of people were able to vote or registered to vote, 86% turned out. There was a number of people who registered or who were registered who didn't participate. Was it that gap, that margin that cost you this?
You know, I think there'll be lots of analysis that'll happen over the next, you know, few weeks, years. We need to make sure that we learn as many lessons as we can, reflect on our messages, what we could have done to improve. But I think, you know, what we can take from this is the fact that Scotland has changed forever, and we have to now work together towards making sure we respect the will of the Scottish people, but do move the country forward, because people wanted change. They want to make sure that we can seek the powers that we want and need for our Parliament. that people didn't, you know, in the numbers that we would have liked, accept independence. But what we need to do now is use the momentum to deliver the change that people in Scotland do want, and use the fact that Scotland is probably one of the most well-informed nations in terms of politics, in terms of economy, anywhere in Europe. And we need to use that and make sure that that enthusiasm, that involvement in politics continues, and that we can use that for the betterment of our country.
Aileen Campbell, member of the Scottish National Party, also a minister at Holyrood, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Very tired looking Alex Salmond, stills of him flashing up on the TV screens just a few moments ago. It's 28 minutes to 9 o'clock.
It's just after 8 o'clock on Friday the 19th of September. This is Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 and RTE News Now with Christopher McKevitt and Gavin Jennings.
The headlines. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has welcomed the rejection of independence by the people of Scotland. 8 people have been killed in a Florida shooting. And the United States is to begin arming and training moderate Syrian rebels to fight the group calling itself Islamic State. Clodagh Walsh has the news in full.
Scotland has voted to remain part of the United Kingdom, with the majority of people rejecting independence in a referendum that attracted a record turnout. The No campaign stands at 55%, while the Yes side stands at 45%, with just one area from the 32 left to declare. Our Deputy Foreign Editor Fiona Mitchell.
Just under an hour ago, the result from Fife confirmed that Scotland had rejected independence. After a long campaign and weeks of polls indicating the results would be neck and neck, the No side was to take the first declaration in the early hours of this morning. The fight back from the Yes side began in Dundee shortly before 4 a.m, but as the results started to roll in, it was clear that the No side was in the lead. A clearly disappointed First Minister Alex Salmond acknowledged this morning that an 86% turnout was a triumph of the democratic process. He pledged to work with all sides to move Scotland forward and to ensure that promises for increased devolution made by the Westminster parties during the campaign are now fulfilled. It was a pledge echoed by his counterpart on the No campaign, Alistair Darling, who told his supporters this morning that the silent had spoken. Fiona Mitchell, RTE News, at the Edinburgh County Centre.
The British Prime Minister, David Cameron, has called for unity following the rejection of independence.
Now the debate has been settled for a generation, or as Alex Salmond has said, perhaps for a lifetime. So there can be no disputes, no reruns. We have heard the settled will of the Scottish people. Scotland voted for a stronger Scottish Parliament, backed by the strength and security of the United Kingdom. And I want to congratulate the No campaign for that, for showing people that our nations really are better together.
Scotland's First Minister, Alex Salmond, has said he accepts the Scottish people have chosen not to become an independent country.
Our referendum was an agreed and consented process, and Scotland has, by majority, decided not, at this stage, to become an independent country. I accept that verdict of the people, and I call on all of Scotland to follow suit in accepting the democratic verdict of the people of Scotland.
In other news, in the United States, a 51-year-old grandfather shot and killed his daughter and her 6 young children at his home in Florida. He then called police and killed himself when they arrived. Our Washington correspondent, Katrina Perry, reports.
28-year-old Sarah Lorraine Spirit and her 6 children spent a lot of time at her father's house. But yesterday afternoon, 51-year-old Don Spirit shot and killed his daughter and the 6 grandchildren. 3 boys aged 4, 8 and 11, 2 girls aged 9 and 5, and a baby girl just 2.5 months old. He then dialed 911 and alarmed the operator with comments about harming others and himself. Police were immediately dispatched to the scene, and upon their arrival, Don Spirit killed himself. Police then entered the property in the small town of Bell, 80 miles southwest of Jacksonville, and found the bodies of Spirit's daughter and grandchildren. The local sheriff said there was no information as to motive, but that the community of just 450 people was devastated. Police confirmed that Don Spirit had a criminal record. He pleaded guilty to the possession of firearms 11 years ago when he accidentally shot dead his 8-year-old son on a hunting trip. Katrina Perry, RTE News, Washington.
a plan to arm and train moderate Syrian rebels to fight the group calling itself Islamic State has been approved by the United States Senate. The US has undertaken hundreds of airstrikes against the group in Iraq since mid-August, after they took control of large areas of Syria and northern Iraq. Airstrikes are now expected in Syria, but Mr. Obama has pledged not to authorize a ground operation in either country. President Obama welcomed the Senate vote, which followed similar approval from the House of Representatives.
I'm pleased that Congress, a majority of Democrats and a majority of Republicans in both the House and the Senate, have now voted to support a key element of our strategy, our plan to train and equip the opposition in Syria so they can help push back these terrorists.
Sierra Leone has imposed a 3-day lockdown on all its citizens as it tries to halt the spread of Ebola. 6 million people have been confined to their homes until Sunday, while volunteers seek out people infected with the disease. The United Nations Security Council has declared Ebola a threat to international peace and security. A resolution called on all countries to provide urgent assistance to the nations affected by the disease. Médecins Sans Frontières has been highly critical of the lockdown. Sandra Smiley is from the medical charity. She says it could potentially help spread the disease instead of containing it.
It's been our experience that lockdowns and quarantine measures don't help control Ebola, in fact, because they end up driving people underground and jeopardizing the trust between people and health providers. So this leads, obviously, to the concealment of potential cases and potentially ends up spreading the disease further.
The US Senate has voted to approve Kevin O'Malley as the new US ambassador to Ireland. The vote was taken shortly before midnight Irish time. President Obama had nominated Mr. O'Malley as US ambassador to Ireland, a post left vacant following the departure of Dan Rooney in late 2012.
23 minutes to 9 o'clock from the United Kingdom to the Kingdom. Pádraic Lodge is here with the sports.
Yes, good morning, Chris. The Kingdom manager Eamon Fitzgerald has named, Eamon Fitzmaurice has named his team for Sunday's All-Ireland football final against Donegal in Croke Park. Two changes to the Kerry team from the win over Mayo in the semi-final replay. Mark O'Shea, who was introduced as a substitute the last day, retains his place in the full back line at the expense of Shane Enright, while Stephen O'Brien, who has recovered from injury, comes into the half-forward line in place of Michael Gainey. Kieran Donaghy starts at full forward and the team will be captained by Fionn Fitzgerald. To analyse the likely outcome on Sunday, we've been speaking to Sunday game analyst and former Dublin midfielder Kieran Whelan.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a big call from Eamon Fitzmaurice. I suppose he's brought Mark O'Shea back in after his performance coming off the bench against Mayo. He got a very good reaction. Stephen O'Brien gives them a direct running option. He's very strong, very direct running with the ball. And then obviously the key decision is Donaghy at full forward, and it's going to be interesting to see how Kerry utilise him in that role, whether he stays in there, whether he comes out. Likewise with James O'Donoghue is the type of player who comes to the game rather than waiting for the game to go to him, and I can see O'Donoghue playing a deeper role also on Sunday, because we know Kerry have to change things up. They can't let their forward line get sucked into the Donegal defensive system. So we're expecting something different from Fitzmaurice and really looking forward to it.
Now, Donegal produced perhaps the performance of the year to beat Dublin in the semi-final. Is there a difficulty perhaps with Jim McGuinness to try and get that sort of similar performance out of the team again?
Well, I suppose that's the biggest challenge for Donegal. They were superb against Dublin, but Dublin really let them play and let them play to their optimum level. There's a lot of wisdom in Kerry, and you know, Eamon Fitzmaurice will have looked closely and learnt a lot from that Dublin performance. So whether they reach that same level again is the big question mark. If they do, it's going to make life very difficult for Kerry. But you know, it remains to be seen. I expect Kerry will drop men back. They certainly won't leave the gaps in defence that Dublin left. It will be an element of cat and mouse to it. I think it will be very tight in the early stages, and both teams will be sussing each other out. So Donegal weren't exactly that strong up to that semi-final. They've reached the 2012 levels now, and if they do get to that level on Sunday, it's going to make it very difficult for Kerry.
So your sense, if you had to call it, was that you're leaning towards Donegal, are you?
Well, having weighed it up, Pádraic, you know, I do think Fitzmaurice will mix it up a bit. Kerry are hard and battled after two great games against Mayo. I'm expecting a big performance from them, But when you weigh up the strengths and weaknesses, I think Donegal have more strengths in terms of the system they bring to it, and Kerry have to change things around, and they may have a few weaknesses in their full back line. And in that regard, I think I'm just leaning towards a tight Donegal win.
That's Kieran Whelan. Sunday's final will be covered live here on RTÉ Radio 1 and on RTÉ 2 television. And according to a report in this morning's Irish Examiner, a man left Fitzgerald Stadium in haste this week after being spotted up a tree trying to watch a Kerry training session. John Fogarty reports that the individual was discovered after the Kerry management noticed branches breaking and heard the rustle of a large palm tree overlooking
his
the pitch.
His name wasn't Doherty or Gallagher, then, I
No, but he fled on foot anyway when he was approached. But no confirmation, but they made calling the special branch to investigate that one. Down have appointed a new manager to succeed James McCartan. As expected, Jim McCorry, manager of county champions Kilcoo, has taken over. On the opening night of Europa League action, Celtic drew 2-2 away to Salzburg of Austria. Donegal's Seamus Coleman was on the score sheet in Everton's 4-1 victory over Wolfsburg at Goodison Park, and Tottenham played out a scoreless draw away to Partizan Belgrade. UEFA will announce the host cities for the 2020 European Championships later today. Dublin is bidding to be one of 13 cities to stage games. And China's Li Na, who was Asia's only Grand Slam singles champion, has announced her retirement from tennis at the age of 32.
There has been a dreadful tragedy in the state of Florida. We're going over to our Washington correspondent, Katrina Perry. Good morning to you, Katrina, or good evening there. What can you tell us?
Well, as you say, Christopher, an extreme tragedy happened in Florida yesterday evening afternoon. At around 4 p.m, 28-year-old Sarah Lorraine Spirit and her six children went to her father's house, as they regularly did. They used to spend a lot of time at his house in the town of Bell, very small town about 80 miles southwest of Jacksonville, population of just 450 people. So they went there to visit her father, the children's grandfathers, and whatever happened, 51-year-old Don Spirit shot his daughter and killed and shot his six grandchildren, three boys, 4-year-old Brandon, 8-year-old Jonathan, 11-year-old Caleb, and three girls, 9-year-old Kylie, 5-year-old Destiny, and Alana, just 2.5 months old. He then dialed 911, and the operator who answered the call was alarmed by the comments that he was making, because he was talking about harm he was going to do to people, harm he had done to people, how he's going to harm himself. So the 911 operator dispatched police to the scene immediately, and upon their arrival they found Don Spirit, and he, when he saw the police coming, then shot and killed himself. Police entered the property and found the bodies of his daughter and his six grandchildren. Now, police were asked in a press conference they gave a short time ago, did they know why this had happened, or was there any indication of motive? And this is what the Gilchrist County Police Sheriff Robert Schultz had to say.
We have no indication of what caused this man to do what he did. And we may never know. There's certainly no signs or indications to us previously that something like this could or was going to happen. And to say that this county, this community, is not going to be devastated from this, from a small county, we're all family here. And what can you say? There's certain things in life that you can explain. There's certain things that you can. This is not one that I can explain.
And that's the sheriff of Gilchrist County in Florida, Sheriff Robert Schultz. Katrina, almost immediately, this horrific crime, this horrific killing of so many children, it echoes, I suppose, the great fear in America about gun control. One thinks back to Sandy Hook and the awful events there of some year and a half ago, year and 11 months ago, 10 months ago. There is obviously a mental health issue here, and there is obviously a gun control issue here.
Well, we have no details really about Don Spirit at this stage, other than police did confirm that he had a criminal record. They didn't go into specifics on that, but we do know that 11 years ago he pleaded guilty to a charge of being a convicted felon in the possession of firearms when he was on a hunting trip, and he accidentally shot dead his then 8-year-old son. Police at the time were, I think, happy enough that it was an accident, but as a result, Don Spirit did spend some time in jail. Police, as you heard in the clip there, have no indication as to motive. They did say that they had been called out to the property several times in recent years for a whole variety of reasons, but they didn't go into details as to what they were at this stage.
a response from fire control activists or firearms control activists, a response from those who would have an interest in mental health issues, or is it too early at this point?
Well, it's almost 2 a.m. in the morning here, so as you'll appreciate, most people who usually give reactions to these type of things aren't probably at their office desks at this time. Okay. So there hasn't been dramatic reaction to that. I think at this point in time, people really are just shocked. I mean, the town where the tragedy happened, it's a very small community, just 450 people. The police sheriff said that, you know, obviously enough, the police department there has never dealt with anything like this before. And in such a small community of only 450 people, losing six children and a young woman, just 28, that's a massive loss for any community to bear, let alone one so small. And the police, the sheriff there was actually quite anxious to point out that they're concerned about the rest of the children in the community who'll wake up to this news tomorrow morning, their friends, their pals, their schoolmates, and you know how they're going to deal with that level of tragedy in a small community.
Katrina Perry, Washington correspondent, with that sad news from Florida. We will leave it there. The time is just coming up to 4 minutes to 7 o'clock.
Stay with sport and Sunday's big game. We heard from Donegal yesterday. Today it's the turn of the county looking for its 37th senior All-Ireland. Our Southern editor Pascal Sheehy has gone home to find out what's driving Kerry.
Okay, lads, it's on a session.
Yeah.
The one thing today, fellas, no distractions. No distractions. Only if you let it become a distraction, then it does become one. Yeah?
It's wind-down time in the Kerry football camp, although you wouldn't know it from the tone of team trainer and selector Kian O'Neill.
Inside only.
Kerry's closed-door policy in relation to squad training sessions has been relaxed temporarily to accommodate the media. But even in this glimpse, the intensity demanded of the players is apparent.
You can only score off a pass! You can only score off a pass, yeah? 1-2, pop over. Let's do it. Let's do it.
This is the pinnacle for an aspiring Kerry footballer. Inside the white lines of Fitzgerald Stadium in early September, preparing for an All-Ireland football final with the best Kerry has to offer.
Boys, we're going into our condition game. Full pitch, full circular pitch. Yeah.
This is the end, or at least approaching the end of a journey. So how do Kerry's footballers end up here? What is it that keeps feeding the county's conveyor belt? And how come Kerry seems to be able to sate the seemingly insatiable appetite for success of its followers with more All-Ireland football titles than any other county in the country?
Okay guys, we're on the hand passing drill. You know what we're looking for here?
The journey begins at GAA clubs like this one all over the county.
Excellent stuff, Connor. Well done, Sennan.
In the shadow of Fitzgerald Stadium, a stone's throw from the Kerry training session, the under-10 footballers of Killarney Legion GAA Club are being coached on the basics of the game by trainer Alan O'Neill.
Let's go, Callum.
Similar scenes are being played out in clubs all over Kerry. The foundations of future inter-county careers are being laid here. Today, these boys are somebody's sons. In a decade or so, thanks to the grounding they will receive here, some of them will be household names in their own right.
Come on, Paddy Griffin!
In the case of Killarney Legion, a decision taken more than a decade ago to invest heavily in its underage players has had far-reaching benefits for both club and county. At the time, the club was struggling. Today, it's thriving. Enda Walsh is vice chairman of Legion GAA Club.
Back in 2000, we had to merge with another local club here to field the minor team, you know? And I mean, here this morning now, and every Saturday morning, we've close to 200 kids up here every Saturday morning. Thankfully, the hard work is bringing rewards and they're all successful as well.
Three players have graduated from the underage care of Legion at these pitches to take their places across the bypass in Killarney and the Kerry training camp. All three are likely to feature for Kerry and Croke Park on Sunday.
Kicking on Mark O'Shea, they need a goal and a save for Brian Kelly.
Goalkeeper Brian Kelly has impressed as a shot stopper in his first full season between the posts for the county.
Harris Johnson line, stepping inside, giving himself a chance to take a shot and put it over the bar.
Wing forward Jonathan Lyne caught the eye in the All-Ireland semi-final replay against Mayo in Limerick. And then there's Gaelic football's hottest property this season.
It's aimed at King Donaghy. He's got it! Donaghy goal for Kerry!
In the absence of the injured Colm Cooper, James O'Donoghue has stepped up as Kerry's scorer-in-chief.
Once upon a time it was Coach Cooper, now it's Donaghy and James O'Donoghue. Long ball, layoff, bang!
Being a goal.
Johnny Colletti is an elder statesman of Kerry football. As a player, trainer and selector, he's been involved in 20 of the county's All-Ireland campaigns. He's been watching the developing James O'Donoghue since James was a boy.
Well, he's a great player now, like, you know, this year he's having a great year, like, you know. He's better all round now than he was, really, you know. He's able to distribute the ball and he's able to score himself off left and right, so he'll be hard to mark.
Right, boys, it's important at home.
And here's where James O'Donoghue honed his skills, under the watchful eye of his father and coach, former All-Ireland winner Dermot O'Donoghue.
He just wants an All-Ireland medal. As I said, Pascal, you're a Kerry man. You have to win the All-Ireland medal. You can be getting awards, but it just doesn't mean anything unless you win the All-Ireland medal.
So on Sunday, Legion GAA Club will take a break from preparing the next generation to concentrate on getting behind the team for this year's All-Ireland final.
And cheers there to end Pascal Sheehy's report ahead of the big game. So much talk about borders this morning, but our border with the sea is the focus of a big clean-up. We're talking about the beaches. With us in studio is Annabel Fitzgerald of Antashka. Thank you very much for coming on. A big clean-up over the next number of days. Tell us.
Yeah, the Big Beach Clean is an initiative run by Antashka's Clean Coast programme. It's happening all around Ireland. There's 100 clean-ups taking place from Carrickfinn in Donegal to Glynn in County Limerick, all the way around the coast, right up to Claverhead and Black Rock in County Louth.
So the big amenities are going to get a little bit of a touch up this weekend. How do you participate? How can I participate? How can everyone else participate?
Well, just log on to our website, bigbeachclean.ie, and there's an interactive map. You can find a cleanup near you. If there's no cleanup on the beach that you love, feel free to start your own cleanup and register online with us.
In relation to what sort of things we're likely to find, I mean, my bugbear is beer cans and Coke cans that have literally come asunder, if you like, with the shale and the beach and so on. There's some pretty dangerous litter out there, not just the unsightly stuff.
Absolutely. You know, there are three main types of litter that we find on our beaches. Recreational, as you mentioned, the cans, the plastic wrappers. We find quite a lot of fishing litter, which is bits of net and rope. And then we find some sewage-related litter. So this is the stuff people are flushing down their toilets, like cotton bud sticks and baby wipes, things that they should be putting in the domestic waste.
So that would be a big thing. If people took a little bit more care at home, we might have a nicer experience on the beach.
Absolutely, yes.
In terms of policing, in terms of that sort of thing, are we good enough at that yet?
We're getting there, but marine litter certainly is a global problem and it's something that we should all take responsibility for. There's a lot that we can do, take our litter home with us, dispose of our litter correctly and ensure that we recycle our waste.
Bins on beaches?
Bins are a great idea on beaches.
We don't have so many though.
Well, we do during the bathing season. It's a requirement of the Blue Flag programme that there are waste facilities on all of our awarded beaches.
Okay, we must leave it there. But Annabel Fitzgerald of Antashka, thanks for coming in. More on the Antashka website if you want to participate in that big beach cleanup. Well, it wasn't our vote, but there's no doubt people here did engage, watch. Some of us stayed up all night to watch that vote coming through. The decision has been made, though, something over 55% of people in Scotland wanting to stay and deciding to stay part of the United Kingdom, just under 45% saying we'd like to go for independence. But of course, the vote is in. Paul Cunningham is on the line from Scotland. First of all, though, we're going to hear a little bit about what it felt like early in the morning on Princes Street in Edinburgh.
Well, I think it's probably the right outcome for Scotland. It's certainly giving notice to Westminster about the problems that have arisen as a result of this referendum. And there's deep problems that are going to have to be faced in the Constitution for the whole of the UK.
I think it's sad for a lot of people, but I think most people could probably see it coming. It was very close, it was always going to be close. And I think that's the real victory here, is the fact that it was as close as it was, and that sends a bit of a message.
There's a large quantity of the country that still associate themselves with the Great Britain movement. Maybe 100 years from now, we might have a group of people who might be prepared to die for Scottish nationalism, but you'll not find anybody on this street today that would.
I'm disappointed. I was a yes voter, but this is why we're a democratic country. People have spoken. It's a no vote, we're staying part of the UK. We all must now come together to be a better nation.
And that was voices there from Princes Street in Edinburgh, talking to our Europe correspondent Paul Cunningham earlier. Paul is on the line for us from Edinburgh. Paul, good morning. It's been quite an exercise in democracy. What's the big point that you would take from what we've witnessed over the last number of days, and indeed overnight?
I think that's just it, Christopher, and an amazing exercise in democracy where so many people came out and cast their ballots. Finding people to talk to on the no side, in other words, the winning side, was rather difficult this morning. But what I did see was most people saying that they wanted to move on and move on together on both sides of the argument. I don't believe that it's going to be hugely divisive. Politically, sure, I think the Scots and the SNP will be pushing to ensure that all of those powers are devolved to the Scottish Parliament. It will have implications for places like Northern Ireland. But on the streets, between the yes and no side, I think people will just move on now. It has been answered, it's a clear result, and that's that.
Paul Cunningham, Europe editor, thank you very much for all the reporting from Scotland. The time is 7 minutes to 9 o'clock.
David Farrell, professor of politics at UCD, is back in our studio, and also is Dan O'Brien, chief economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs and columnist with Independent Newspapers. David Farrell, to you first of all. We heard from David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, earlier in the programme, moving very quickly to say that he's going to honour this vow that was given by him and the leaders of the other two main parties, not just to voters in Scotland, but to voters in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, that more power is going to be ceded from London to them. What's that going to mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he's giving a very subtle signal here that is being picked up now by the journalists quite quickly, that we have this bizarre situation that a no for Scottish independence has effectively, as somebody was tweeting earlier on, morphed into a yes for English devolution. We're heading into a British general election in a couple of months' time. All the main parties are now going to be focusing on England and the debate in England and devolution in England and how that's going to be done. Is it going to be an English Parliament, as clearly the Conservatives would want, or is it going to be some kind of regional devolution to the English regions, as the Labour Party would
want? This is the phrase, the West Lothian question. In other words, why do Scottish MPs, while they have their own Parliament, continue to have votes in an English Parliament, yeah, as they do now?
And you can imagine the scenario where a future Labour government elected in the light of them solving the West Lothian question as Cameron would like to resolve it, in ending up in a bizarre situation where they have a minority in among English MPs, so they're wrong-footed.
Isn't this the win-win scenario for the Tories and for David Cameron?
And for UKIP,
that the likelihood of a Labour Party government, a single-party government, if they weren't to have MPs from Scotland or Wales, is next to none.
That's right. So that's why the battle lines are now going to be drawn very quickly among the mainstream parties in Britain as to the battle over England, and that's where the focus is going to shift. So Scotland's had its moment. Attention is now going to shift south.
Dan O'Brien, we've been assessing what the likely economic implications for here would be in the event of a yes vote. In the event of a no vote, does anything change?
I don't think it does, and I'd be slightly sceptical about the idea that everything, the British constitutional political order, is going to change with all sorts of consequences, including economic. All the way back to the 1600s, the evolution of the British political constitutional order has been almost uniquely stable. The British don't go for rupture and radical change. Just 10 years ago, people in the north of England rejected regional parliaments. Just 2 years ago, most of the big cities rejected having greater municipal powers, mayors. I don't buy the idea that the British people, the English, the Scottish, want a radical change to their constitutional political order. When they've had the opportunity to vote, including yesterday, they've tended to say no to it. There will be a review process, but I am not convinced that the change is going to be as big as most people are now sort of saying, that this has let the genie out of the bottle and it's a game changer. I'm not at all convinced by that.
So from our purposes, can we simply ignore the result and move on?
Well, I'd never say ignore it. You know, it's something to watch, but looking at that history and that history of gradualism in Britain, I think there will be some devolution of powers. Things will change slightly, but I don't anticipate a radical change. So something like corporation tax, if Scotland and Northern Ireland have an opportunity to to set the corporation tax at a different level. My hunch would be that it will be within a narrow band. They're not going to be given complete freedom to do it, but there will be a narrow band within which they can move it, so there won't be that much regional disparity within the United Kingdom as it stands.
David Farrell, while Britain has a general election next year, we're expecting to have another number of referendums next year, one of which would be to extend the voting age to people between the ages of 16 and 18. They voted, we gather, in very large numbers in the Scottish referendum. Now, we don't really know how they voted, how that vote broke down, but the fact is they did come out and vote.
That's right. I mean, there are some real positives from this recent referendum, and that cannot be denied. The passion in the debates leading up to the final result, passion including a lot of young citizens, 16 and 17-year-olds who came out in force before the election. Massive turnout, the highest turnout we've seen on these islands in any referendum, bar none. And of course, this huge youth vote. We don't know how it's going. The opinion polls in the eve of the election suggested that it was dividing pretty evenly among the younger citizens. But the fact was they were turning out, and they were proving the point that I think needs to be demonstrated in the referendum we're going to have next year on this. You can trust young citizens to be engaged in politics.
Yeah, Dan O'Brien, I heard a number of people remarking overnight during coverage from the UK that to see somebody in a polling booth beside them voting in a school uniform was something that they felt glad about. Not that they didn't trust young people to vote, but they thought, yes, good luck to them.
I think there certainly is a case for a 16-year-old. I think back to a long time ago when I was 16. I'm not sure I was quite maybe mature enough to be making big decisions like that, but I certainly think there is a case for lowering the age, all right.
David Farrell, we spoke to Gerry Adams earlier on, who, again, it's part of Sinn Féin policy that they want a border poll. They will no doubt use the Scottish example as a precedent for it. Do you think that's likely in the next couple of years, given what we've just seen overnight?
I don't think so. I think this sort of... the Scottish thing proves that you can shoot that fox quite easily. There's a danger that if you run for this particular campaign too soon, you're going to lose it. I think it would be wise on the part of Sinn Féin just to buy their time and wait for a better opportunity than this.
As David Cameron put it earlier on this morning, as far as he's concerned, the independence debate in Britain has now been settled for a generation. David Farrell and Dan O'Brien, thank you both very much for coming into our studio. A reminder that there will be continuing coverage of the Scottish referendum result on Morning Edition on RTE News Now after this programme. It's a minute to nine.